This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
As a psychiatrist, I'm supposed to believe there's an explanation for everything. Curious behaviors, unusual symptoms, even when they edge into the uncanny, the human mind is a tangled but ultimately knowable place. That's what I told myself when Leonard first arrived on Ward B. His intake notes barely filled half a page. Voluntary admission, mid-40s, found wandering city streets. No reported violence or self-harm, just a persistent silence. He would look back at whoever spoke to him, eyes unblinking and watery, as if gathering every detail. My first interview, he sat perfectly still, arms loosely wrapped around himself. No answers, not even nods. Only at the end, when the nurse entered, did he say anything. He repeated a comment she'd made 3 hours earlier, the exact same tone and laugh. We exchanged a look across his shoulder, discomfort settling in before I could brush it off. Routine therapy was pointless. He wouldn't speak at all in session. But after a few days, word spread among the staff. Someone working nights reported hearing their own voice echo from the rec room after they'd finished cleaning up. Same pitch, same words, called back a beat later. Another dismissed it as a weird intercom malfunction. The audio wiring in the building was ancient, but the oddness kept building. On the fourth night, the ward was quiet, the kind of hush that's heavy and expectant. I stayed late to review files when I heard familiar laughter down the hall. A friend from medical school who joined staff recently. When I peered past the nurse's station, she was gone. But in her place was Leonard, sitting by the aquarium and chuckling, just like her. The laugh died as soon as I entered. He stared at his hands, motionless once again. The phenomenon spread. Leonard started repeating patient complaints in private, using people's intonation almost perfectly. Sometimes it was harmless, imitating how another psychiatrist sighed or the way an orderly hummed an off-key tune when mopping. But other times he'd parrot things no one seemed to have said within earshot. A patient recounted a traumatic event in morning group, only to hear it later, spoken out loud from the direction of the supply closet, her exact voice shaky and frightened. Only Leonard was there. Cameras showed him sitting by himself, lips parted but unmoving. Nights grew more unsettled. there was an incident with the phone system. Two orderlies went to take a call in the break room and heard their own voices, a snippet of a joke told privately hours earlier, played back with a nasal, flat tone. The voicemail system kept filling up with garbled messages that seemed to imitate, word for word, staff complaints from the previous day. We disabled the intercom, suspecting crossed wiring or someone pulling an elaborate prank, which would have been a relief. Leonard barely ate, but staff found him standing in doorways, perfectly still, lips silently moving. I glimpsed him once and realized with a jolt he was echoing my dictation notes to his file from earlier. Not only the words, but my pauses, my throat clearing, minute for minute. I watched his hands mimic the nervous gestures of a new nurse, ringing in sync, his eyes wide and too alert. It got worse. One evening, Leonard's room was empty during nighttime checks. The alarms never went off, but the nurses heard their own voices arguing, muffled through the vent near the day room, an argument that had occurred in private two floors away. When they finally found him, he was crouched by the vent, lips moving, tears streaming down his blank face. More and more, patients became agitated. They claimed Leonard was whispering their secrets at night through the thin walls, even when he was under constant observation. Some reported hearing their own voices call out from the hallway, only to see Leonard's silhouette vanishing back into his room. The shared phone at the end of the ward began picking up fragments of staff and patient conversations, replayed at odd hours when the receiver was lifted, low, distant, yet unmistakably real. Several orderlies refused to work nights after finding Leonard standing just inside the med closet, reciting a patient's deeply personal confession he had no conceivable way of knowing. He stood in silence if spoken to directly, but a few hours later, the exact same words would float out from behind a closed linen closet in a perfect copy of the original voice and accent. As a rationalist, I tried to document everything, audio logs, incident reports, consulting technicians about cross circuits or deliberate mischief. The hospital's IT department ran a battery of tests and found nothing significant. A few senior staff attributed it all to group stress, echoing behavior, and Leonard's extreme case of echolalia. But none had seen a case with this intensity or this eerie precision. The closest explanation was that he was a savant, obsessively skilled at mimicry and reading lips. Maybe he overheard more than anyone guessed during rounds. Eventually, we transferred Leonard to a more specialized facility, citing patient safety and harmony. The days after he left, the strange echoes stopped. The phone lines were quiet again, and no staff heard their own voices replayed from behind doors. Still, at times, I find myself alone in my office late at night, dictating notes, and I hesitate, half waiting for my own voice to bounce back from an empty corner, repeating my words just a second too late, in that same flat tone. There are explanations that fit if I repeat them often enough. But some mimicries echo longer than you'd expect, trailing behind like a shadow waiting to speak. Story note 2, I work overnight shift maintenance at an old psychiatric hospital built in the 50s. Not much phases me. The halls always groan or rattle, and most so-called ghost stories end up being leaky pipes or drafty vents. The boiler room, though, that's where stuff started happening I still can't explain, no matter how many times I run through it. My job is pretty simple. Sweep the linoleum, take out trash, make sure nobody's smoking in corners they shouldn't be, and every couple of nights, check the big old boilers in the sub-basement. That place always stinks of sour steam and something oily. It's hotter than hell in the summer, teeth chattering cold in the winter, no matter what the gauges say. Every time I step inside, the door seems to close behind me, heavier than it should, even when it's propped with a mop. The first odd thing happened last December. Some nurses complained about banging sounds from the basement that kept waking up patients above. By the time I got down there, the noises had stopped. I figured a pipe had shifted or maybe air in the system. Old buildings groan, nothing new. But then my radio kept crackling with static every time I passed the boilers, even though nowhere else in the hospital did it. One night I heard what sounded like faraway mumbling, nearly words, just on the edge of understanding. I tried blaming the radio, but even with the radio off, the sound stuck around, bouncing in the steam that hugged the ceiling. A week later, I picked up a cheap little tape recorder from the Lost and found to keep myself company, recording notes and reminders. Down by the boiler room one night, the tape picked up not just my humming and shuffling, but clear, mechanical breathing. Not mine. This was colder, ragged at the end, very slow. I only noticed it when I played the tape back upstairs. I convinced myself it was some mechanical whine, maybe my own nose, but the sound didn't match anything I remembered. I switched to earbuds the following night to distract myself, but my music kept cutting out near the boiler door, replaced by low, echoing knocks that only played in one ear. The temperature would drop sharply, even when the boilers rumbled hot. My breath would cloud up near the back pipes, which didn't make any sense. That's where the hospital kept piles of old equipment, broken wheelchairs, cracked bed frames, even a few battered patient records boxed and forgotten. Sometimes I'd notice my sleeves wet with condensation for no good reason, or the strong smell of bleach, even when I hadn't used any. I told myself I was tired, maybe stressed about picking up extra shifts, but that didn't explain the things that started moving around. Once, a wrench I left on top of the water heater ended up 30 feet away, wedged in the narrow crawl space behind an old generator, even though I was sure I was alone. Another time, the heavy old boiler pressure gauge unscrewed itself and thumped onto the concrete, rolling right up to my shoes. The supervisor shrugged and called it vibrations, which would be fine, except it never happened anywhere else in the building. It got weirder. One night, I caught a glimpse of what looked like a child-sized shadow ducking around behind the tanks, moving faster than I could track. At the same time, the pipes let out short bursts of what sounded like laughter mashed up with static. Sharp, high-pitched, gone as quick as it came. My hands shook so bad I dropped my flashlight, and when I picked it up, the lens was slick and fogged from the inside. The smell in the room was different that night. Heavy with a tang like burnt rubber mixed with something sharp and sterile, like a hospital hallway before rounds. I started taking breaks outside, even when it was freezing. That's when I noticed my uniform pockets would sometimes feel damp, a metallic slime at the bottom. And when I reached in, my fingertips stung cold for minutes. More than once, my boots picked up sooty streaks, like I'd walked through ash, even when the floor had just been cleaned. Sometimes after a bad...
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Night, my hands would be marked with faint smears, odd symbols I never recognized, rubbing away with proper washing. I blamed the cleaning supplies, but it never happened anywhere but the boiler room. Twice I left my tape recorder running on a shelf while I did my rounds. Both times on playback, there were voices. The first was slow, whispering in what sounded like another language, broken up by mechanical sighs. The second was worse, low, urgent, almost chanting words I could almost, but not quite, understand. One of the nurses I trust listened and said it just sounded like pipes, old air hissing. Maybe it was. I threw the recorder out after that. The final straw came when I heard footsteps, bare, plodding, and wet, coming from the utility closet just past the boiler. The room was locked from the inside. When I pried it open with keys, the lights flickered, and I saw the condensation forming slow shapes on the back wall, like tiny child-sized handprints that slowly faded as the heat returned. I tried scrubbing them off, but they always came back for weeks after, thinner and more stretched every time, until there was nothing left but faint outlines and the sharp scent of bleach. Nobody else on staff ever stuck around down there longer than they had to. The higher-ups always offered explanations: electrical surges, air pressure, old equipment, my own nerves. Maybe they're right. But sometimes when I walk past the basement doorway, I still hear the faint brush of static, and I swear something hums in time with my own breathing, just waiting for the tape to roll again. Story No. 3. I've worked a lot of night shifts in the isolation wing, so I thought I'd seen everything. Detox nightmares, panic attacks, patients claiming the lights talk to them. But all that feels normal compared to what happened last year with Mr. Delaney. He's the one I think about when the ward's lights are out and the halls go weirdly quiet. Delaney arrived late spring, a transfer from another hospital. His notes said chronic delusional parasitosis, which means he believed bugs were crawling under his skin. The usual protocol is simple: monitor self-harm, keep him clean, calm, meds as needed. He scratched endlessly at his arms and neck, which I expected, but there was a desperation to it that made my skin crawl just to watch. He'd mutter, but what unsettled me wasn't the words. It was that he only seemed to scratch late at night, as if something triggered him when the halls got dark and still. It started as just worrying about infection. On my second shift with him, I noticed he'd drawn blood at the crook of his elbow and around the wrist. But the wounds weren't open for long. By rounds, they would close into angry red welts, like bites, often in patterns that looked almost purposeful. When I changed his sheets, I found little flakes, hard, pale bits shaped like broken fingernails, only thicker, almost like something shed by an insect. I assumed it was his skin, cracked from all the scratching, but they didn't match his nail clippings and felt strangely tough. I glove up for everyone, but with Delaney, I doubled up. Something about touching the sheets made my hands tingle, as if tiny pins were pricking my palms. I chalked it up to a long night or nerves, but the feeling started to follow me home, almost like static electricity that wouldn't discharge. In the next week, three orderlies rotated off the ward, all of them reporting rashes up their arms, angry red spots that burned but faded within hours. The ER doctor checked for bed bugs, scabies, the usual culprits. Nothing turned up but irritated skin, and the marks didn't fit any pattern. Patients across the hall complained of itching too. I started to feel it, a deep, crawling feeling under my own sleeve cuffs that left nothing to see but a faint red splotch. When I shampooed my hair at home, I sometimes pulled away more hair than usual, strands tangled in my fingers. Some nights, Delaney's agitation drew other patients. Those on the same hall would wake terrified, claiming the sheets crawled or that someone was breathing in their ear. Several times they woke with identical scratches in the same places Delaney scratched: wrists, forearms, back of the neck. I checked the beds, the mattresses, the shower drains, every time half expecting to find a nest of something. Never did. Maintenance said I was looking too hard for patterns. Still, when I handled his pillow, my hands always felt cold shortly after and stayed cold, tinged numb for half an hour. One night I thought I saw movement under his blanket, a ripple, like a mouse running under fabric, but too sinuous and sharp to be a rodent. Pulling the cover back quickly, there was nothing underneath but Delaney, sweating, eyes open wide, wild with terror. His lips kept moving. I thought it was spittle on his chin, but under the bright light it looked like a thin glistening thread, clear and sticky, gone by morning, as if he'd never touched it. Housekeeping started complaining next. They'd find small puddles under his bed, sometimes sticky and amber, sometimes a fine gray dust on the metal bed frame. No infections, no physical cause. It always wiped up easily, except for an odd scent like sour honey and bleach that lingered hours after. As the days passed, the night staff began finding bite marks on themselves, round, ring-shaped patterns that appeared only after working Delaney's side of the ward. I dismissed the first few as psychosomatic, easy to do when everyone's talking about it. But when I found two perfect rings, small and raised just above my elbow, I wore long sleeves for a month. CCTV sometimes froze at Delaney's door overnight. Security noticed flickering shadows under the slit, like many thin things moving quickly. But there was never anything outside when the feed resumed. Once, between 2 and 3 a.m., cameras inside his room glitched with static, the screen twitching as if crawling with lines. Then briefly, a shape bunched beneath Delaney's sheet, breaking into shifting lumps before flattening again. The day nurse said it was just compression artifacts, but it looked exactly like a coiling thing moving under his skin and bedding. The final week before his transfer, Delaney grew quiet. His skin cleared, scratching stopped. It was almost worse. He just stared at the ceiling, eyes tracking invisible things. The flare-ups among staff and patients dropped off, though no one slept well, and cleaning still found wisps of gray, chitin-like fragments on the floor. He left just as suddenly as he came. The room was cleaned, painted, and never reassigned. Sometimes the faint chemical scent returns on humid nights, and even now, after scrubbing, I sometimes catch myself staring at my own arms in the mirror, waiting to see if something's moving under. The doctors called it delusional parasitosis, a textbook case, only maybe a little contagious, not physically, but in the mind. That's what I repeat when my skin tingles with invisible itch, and I wonder if something was really left behind at all. Story No. 4. I've been an orderly at Norwood Psychiatric Center for almost 5 years, mostly doing evening shifts and a few long overnights when staff is thin. There isn't much that surprises me anymore. Not patients yelling at shadows, not random streaks on the walls, not even the tantrums when meds are missed. But the thing with the mirror in the South Common Room is the one story I never tell new hires, because sometimes just speaking about it feels like an invitation. When it first started, it was just an odd quirk. We had an old rectangular mirror above the sinks in the common room. Every other week, some patient would be caught whispering to their own reflection, pausing to stare at their lips like they were waiting for a reply. Maria, our new admit that March, was the main one. She'd fix her eyes on her own face for so long her breath would fog up the glass. Then she'd trace shapes. The rest of us figured she was just dissociating or communicating with herself. Sometimes she'd tap the mirror 3 times, then shuffle away with her head down. Then one night I was doing a round before lights out. The cleaning staff had done a once-over, but there was a faint word on the glass that hadn't been wiped away. Talk back. Looked like it had been scratched there, only shallow, but the letters caught the light at just the right angle. The night nurse laughed, told me it must have been done with a fingernail and probably wouldn't come off. I shrugged it off, figuring it was harmless, maybe some patient's way of getting under our skin. But there was something odd about it. The font, if you could call it that, didn't look like any of their handwriting from chart entries or the marks they'd leave on the whiteboards. Within a week, others started to act strange around the mirror. I'd pass patients waiting who'd stop, shake their heads, and back away from it, as if their own reflection surprised them. A couple refused to use the sink in that room, saying nothing, just skirting the countertop like something might reach out. During cleaning checks, I'd notice little patches of condensation only around that mirror, even on cool nights. It had a smell to it too, almost coppery, like pennies and cleaning alcohol. Sabrina, another orderly, pointed out a handprint that appeared halfway up the glass. Larger than my own, but too thin, too elongated. The print lasted an entire shift before fading, even after being cleaned. Some nights it would reappear, almost oily, slightly smeared, always in the same patch of the mirror, like someone was pressing from the other side. The kind of mark you'd find if you were desperate to get attention. The stories from patients grew more unsettling. A man who'd never shown any sort of delusions started standing in front of the mirror, not saying anything, just watching. He'd tilt his head, move his mouth like he was speaking, but nothing would come out. He ended up transferred after repeating to the staff over and over that the mirror was copying too slow. One of the nurses saw his lips move in the mirror just a half a beat off from his actual mouth, almost like a video lag, but no one else witnessed it, and cameras don't face that direction. I started to keep my eyes down when I walked past, but you could still catch glimpses, the flash of reflected movement. the feeling of something shifting at the edges of your vision. I'd catch myself pausing, caught by some urge to stare back. Two or three times I thought I saw writing from the corner of my eye, short phrases that disappeared when I focused, as if someone had fogged them with breath. After a particularly long shift, I saw "Don't trust it" barely outlined in faint residue. This time, my own hand started shaking, and I wiped the words away with the hem of my shirt. When I looked down, a line of fine scratches ran across my palm, as if I'd pressed into broken glass. Sometimes in the early hours, I'd walk the halls alone and hear faint tapping, a sequence of three coming from the common room. Nothing on the security feed ever matched. No patients up, no staff in the room. Still, on two occasions, I found fresh droplets of water under the mirror, even though the faucet was dry and the room hadn't been used in hours. I argued with myself that it was just suggestibility. Old hospitals always feel odd late at night under fluorescent lights, after all. The mirror had probably warped with age or had some invisible residue that played tricks on our eyes. Patients with certain disorders might parrot each other, behavior spreading like infection among people already struggling. Maintenance replaced the mirror after it cracked, almost spontaneously during a routine cleaning. But within a week, a similar haze started to develop across the new glass. A subtle handprint, a single word, "look." And patients went right back to avoiding it. The reports of delayed reflections died down, but some staff still swear they hear breathing or muffled words when they're alone in the common room, especially near dawn. I tell myself that if there's something wrong, it's the wiring or our tired brains making patterns from nothing. But some shifts, I feel drawn to the mirror, like the weight of a stare on the back of my neck. I keep my eyes down and move quickly, not because I believe the stories, but because sometimes, in the warped reflection, my mouth seems just a little too slow to move. Just enough that I don't want to watch long enough to finish the sentence. Story No. 5. They brought her in late autumn, during one of those cold snaps that makes the entire mental hospital seem twice as old. She called herself Lena, skinny, quiet, maybe 15, with limp black hair, and a notebook she never seemed to let go of, no matter how many times we checked her for contraband. The intake notes said severe social withdrawal, possible psychotic depression. They didn't say anything about the way she watched corners or how she always knew when someone was about to enter the room, even with her back to the door. On my first week working her wing, I started noticing small, strange things. She'd shuffle along the halls, notebook pressed to her chest, eyes fixed on the floor like she was tracing invisible lines. Sometimes, she'd stand in front of the nurse's station waiting for staff to finish a shift, even when changes were unscheduled or we swapped over at odd hours. Her sense of timing was uncanny, but I shrugged it off as a patient picking up on routine. The real strangeness began with the doors. I found Lena in the service hallway near the locked electrical supply room, sketching nervously. The door behind her is always supposed to be secured. Nobody but maintenance has the key. But there she stood, hand pressed on the knob, notebook open to a neat diagram of hallways. The drawing showed the hospital almost perfectly, but there were extra lines, rooms that didn't exist, and curving corridors labeled in handwriting so small I'd have needed a magnifying glass. I tried to forget it. Days passed, but the weirdness ramped up. She'd vanish during group therapy and be found in random storage spaces staff weren't supposed to access without a security badge. Once, a social worker found her in the archives room, sitting cross-legged on the tile, humming to herself and sketching symbols in the dust. There were no broken locks or forced doors. No one saw her enter or leave. It was as if Lena could slip from place to place when nobody was watching. At night, I started to sense her moving through the halls during rounds. Sometimes I'd check the patient rooms, see her bed empty, and immediately start a search, only to double back and find her curled beneath the blanket, breathing slow and regular, as if she'd never left. I wondered if it was sleepwalking. Plenty of patients did, and our eyes play tricks in the flickering security monitors. Still, it unnerved me how swiftly she seemed to pop in and out of locked areas without tripping alarms. The notebook unsettled other staff even more than me. Lena filled it with blueprints and maps, always adding new sections. Stairs to nowhere, elongated crawl spaces, doors that led to empty white. She drew clusters of eyes in corners, sometimes long figures barely visible, standing the wrong way up or suspended from the ceiling. On her third week, she started drawing staff figures. The night shift nurse crouched beside a set of invisible doors, the janitor standing in a corridor that didn't exist. No one could say why, but the air felt colder when she handed them these sketches. Other patients started sleepwalking. One boy from down the hall was found in the far west storage closet, shivering and barefoot, muttering about the girl with the maps. Doors that should have been locked tight clicked open to reveal cleaned but unused rooms, their dust disturbed by tiny footprints. Staff chalked it up to janitors leaving doors ajar or shifts running together. But I checked those rooms. I'd cleaned most myself. I knew what a recently opened storage closet looked like, and these always felt wrong. As if someone had been there seconds before, but left no sign apart from the lingering scent of old paper and something musty, like turned earth. The staff room started getting signs too. Chalk lines, impossibly pale, would appear on the tiles, twisting into spirals and then vanishing the next time the cleaning crew came through. Once I found a single black hair pinned beneath the supply closet door, even though Lena's room was on the opposite side of the ward. Surveillance tape made things worse. We checked the monitors after a particularly rough night. Lena was there one frame, gone the next, reappearing four corridors away in less than a second, glitchy and indistinct. The next few nights, the feeds glitched between 2:04 and 2:09 a.m., always as she left her room. IT insisted it was low bandwidth and poor old cameras. As winter closed in, patients grew tense. Some scribbled cryptic messages, directions and warnings, coordinates that meant nothing to us. A few refused to sleep alone, insisting Lena had whispered to them about new doors opening at dusk, about shortcuts that only she could see. The last incident stays with me more than the rest. We found Lena missing from her room in the early hours of a snowstorm. We scoured every corner, checked every closet, even the sealed-off tunnel in the basement. Nothing. Her notebook was found resting on the end of her bed, closed for the first time. The top page showed a perfect map of the building, except the last page was covered in sprawling black lines converging to a point, like a tiny door opening into blackness. I ran my finger over the page and felt a chill creep up my arm, like something cold and smooth had brushed past beneath my skin. They called the police, but no evidence turned up. No footprints in the snow, just a sense of still air and a closed door. Staff went on with their routines, telling themselves she must have found an open window. Someone left a door unlocked. The notebook was just a coincidence. Even now, I still sometimes see faint chalk lines on the floor, where no one's walked or hear a door softly click open in an empty corridor. I tell myself it's just memory, an old building settling, a girl with clever hands making the most of 24 blind spots. But every time I check one of the storage closets in the dead of night, I brace for what might be waiting inside, the sense of a gap that shouldn't be there, and Lena's eyes watching from the other side. Story No. 6. Working the night shift on the male ward, you get used to all kinds of crying. Different patients, different sounds. Some sob quiet under the covers, some howl, some mumble for hours. But the kind of weeping that started last year on Ward 3 felt off. There's no other way to put it. The sort of thing you don't forget, no matter how much you tell yourself it's all in your head or someone else's nerves rubbing off. The first week, it was just isolated events. I'd go to check on the patients around 2:30, my quietest round, when everyone else was supposed to be deeply asleep. On three different nights, I'd find one or two patients in tears, sometimes so deeply asleep they couldn't even react when I put a hand on their shoulder. Faces covered in tears, hair damp, shoulders trembling. When they woke for breakfast, none of them remembered a thing. My supervisor said it was common for trauma patients, or sometimes even meds interfering with REM cycles. Then it started happening to more patients. Sometimes as many as 5 or 6 on the same wing, always at the same time, around 3:15. I started to think there might be some low-level group effect, patients feeding off each other's distress, even while asleep. But some of these beds were separated by thick walls, and a couple were on opposite sides of the ward. That's when I noticed the water. Not just tears, but actual wet patches around the heads of the beds, sometimes damp on the sheets, almost like someone had spilled a pitcher in the dark. The pillows were heavier, cold to the touch, with a strange stagnant smell, something between hospital disinfectant and lake water. The cleaners said the windows must be leaking, but the frames never showed a sign of moisture, and sometimes the stains would dry into little rings right over the patient's head. About 2 weeks in, the handprints started. It was subtle at first, on the higher window panes, faint and pale, as if someone with cold hands had pressed there from the inside, always above the beds of the men who woke up soaked in tears. The prints sat higher than anyone could reach without standing on a chair, and none of my elderly or medicated men were climbing up there. I wiped them away, but by the next night there'd always be one set back, sometimes two side by side with tiny fingers. One Wednesday, a patient named Michael began waking up in a panic, convinced that a boy, all blue with hair stuck to his face, was standing in the corner staring at him. His roommate, technically comatose from a mix of meds and severe withdrawal, started shuddering so hard at night that the railings rattled. 3 days after Michael started talking about the blue boy, two more men on the ward began waking up crying, all with the same description of someone watching them from the dark, soaking wet. I asked around and none of the daytime nurses had heard anything weird, except that some patients refused showers on certain days, insisting it made them colder, even under hot water. My night partner once said she felt a blast of freezing air when she walked past the old shower room, the one that's been locked up ever since an incident years ago, before my time. The maintenance guy checked the vents, found nothing, and changed the subject. Sometimes after a night of collective weeping, the atmosphere on the ward felt heavy, like summer before a thunderstorm. Except this was winter. The walls would bead with condensation near the doors, and I'd smell something sour and faintly moldy in the hall, clinging just above floor level. I'd see damp footprints, not only from patients, but once or twice shaped too small for any of our men, snaking from the direction of the shower block and fading halfway down the corridor. I started keeping a towel in my bag just to dry areas quickly before anyone could slip. Nights grew heavier as the weeks dragged. The sound of muffled crying became more frequent, always in the dead hours. Sometimes I'd find two patients crying in sync, mirroring each other's movements, even if they were separated by a corridor. Occasionally, I'd catch what sounded like someone humming just under my breath in the silence, rising and falling in time to the weeping. Once I passed by the staff window and saw in the reflection what looked like a third shape huddled beside a crying patient. Gone when I looked back in the room. At that point, I started dreading the rounds more than I cared to admit. The doctors blamed group hysteria, environmental factors, or sleep disturbances. Maybe it was just suggestion or anxiety creeping out in strange ways. Still, the crying, the water, the prints on the glass never made sense. Security footage caught the crying sometimes, but never showed anything unusual. The handprints, the footprints, the freezing cold, the shadow in the reflections, those were all things I tried to record, but somehow it never showed up quite right on photos or tapes. Eventually, the pattern faded. A few patients got transferred. A couple went home. The handprints stopped. The crying became just another part of the ward's background noise. Still, sometimes, when the wind is right, and all the lights flicker at 3 a.m., I get the urge to check the windows for prints I know won't be there, and listen for that small, wet, hopeless sobbing you can only really hear in dreams. Maybe it was all nerves, maybe it was something else. Either way, I keep a towel handy, and I never open the old shower room door, no matter how bad the leak looks in the morning. Story No. 7. You get used to strange things in my line of work. I've been an orderly on the geriatric psych floor for almost 8 years, long enough to learn which sounds come from cracked pipes, which complaints are products of medication, and which are just the mind-playing tricks halfway between dusk and dawn. But for every pattern, there's a patient who doesn't fit. I'd say Marlena was the rarest of all. She was in her late 60s when she came to us, wiry, sharp-eyed, unusually alert for dementia, even if she sometimes drifted in long, silent spells. Marlena was known for one habit, sniffing the air, long and deliberate, pinching her nostrils and grimacing. Sometimes she described phantom smells no one else noticed. Sweet, rotten, metallic, or green, like wilted cut flowers. The nurses wrote it off as age-related hallucination, maybe side effects from all her pills. But after a few months, a pattern emerged. Marlena would complain about a new scent, always specific but never the same. Moldy oranges, bleach, burnt leaves, and within days, something bad happened on the floor. One night, she swore the air was thick with lilacs and mothballs. 48 hours later, Mrs. Donnelly, who'd seemed relatively healthy, slipped into a sudden fatal cardiac event. On another shift, Marlena sniffed me and whispered about motor oil. I chuckled behind her back, but the next day, the ancient facility elevator collapsed several floors, miraculously empty but out of commission for weeks. The management considered her episodes coincidence or sundowning, that drift in awareness near dusk that brings all sorts of bizarre behaviors. Still, staff got nervous. Whenever she sniffed and wrinkled her nose a certain way, aides subconsciously found jobs on the opposite side of the building. Marlena rarely left her room after dark, but her claims always echoed for days after. It wasn't just the premonition. Soon the smells themselves seemed to start leaking into other people's perceptions. My own turning point came on a cloudy Monday when I was collecting linens outside her room. As soon as I reached her door, I caught this overwhelming whiff of sweet rot, compost, and perfume. I left the sheets on my cart and pushed the feelings aside. The next day, Marlena told anyone who'd listen that someone she could smell was about to leave us. By the weekend, another patient, Mr. Graves, had a stroke. Staff who went to clean his room afterward said it reeked of gardenias, though the family claimed he hated flowers and never kept them. From then on, whenever Marlena sniffed the air and described a scent, I found myself paying attention. Sometimes the odor would show up in odd places, the kitchen vent, the staff closet, even the elevator long after it was fixed. Once I caught the scent of metal and old rain in the laundry room at midnight. 2 days later, a staff member on light duty slipped and broke her hip there. Items also started to move. Marlena kept a collection of buttons, but sometimes I'd see them arranged in patterns on her tray after she made a prediction. Circles, crosses, even what looked like tiny figures. A set of false teeth appeared under my chair one night after she commented about the taste of copper. The next morning, the patient in the bed next door was discovered in respiratory distress, blood on her lips. The calls from Marlena became more disturbing as she grew familiar with staff. She could identify nurses by scent alone, even those she'd never met except across the hall, sometimes mentioning future events. An aide's father dying, a night nurse being reassigned, a medication error no one had yet noticed. Sometimes she'd borrow scents, reporting smelling a nurse's perfume even when none was worn, only to learn later of a loss or accident in the nurse's family. Other patients occasionally complained of odors, burnt hair, stale bread, grass. If I followed up, someone on the ward would deteriorate, even if it was expected, or there'd be a strange accident. Light bulbs bursting, the air thick with ozone and static for hours after. Marlena's own room changed too. More and more I found it cold, the light flickering. There would be traces of odd substances, powder, wilted petals, sometimes what looked like rusty water in the sink. Once her blanket was braided through with dead dandelion stems. I cleaned, but the items always reappeared. Hospital higher-ups blamed forgetful hands or practical jokers, but the maintenance crew grew quieter, and some started swapping shifts to avoid her hallway. She grew thin as winter approached. One evening, I walked past her room and she caught my eye, smiling in a way that showed far too many teeth for comfort. She whispered something about smoke and fresh paint. My hands went clammy. The next morning, a small electrical fire broke out in the med closet. No one got hurt, but the smoke alarms failed and the air tasted scorched for days. Sometimes Marlena would comfort the dying, claiming what they needed before they asked. A favorite scent, the right words, the name of a pet. Nurses swore she sat with two patients the moment they passed, humming old hymns. The chapel smelled of violets and pine for a week. She died quietly in her sleep a month later. Everyone breathed easier, but the peculiar events haven't quite stopped. Some nights, when the building goes still and my mind drifts, a smell creeps in. Wet earth, candle wax, faded cologne, always before someone receives bad news. Story No. 8. As a psychiatrist in a sleep disorders ward, I've encountered more strange cases than I can remember. Still, I wasn't prepared for Emily, And the way those months with her changed the way I felt about my own nights. Emily arrived at our hospital on referral from a general facility that couldn't help her. 17 years old, dark circles under watchful eyes, skin always pale and clammy. She claimed she hadn't slept a full night in weeks, that dreams made her sick. The first exam, I clocked her vitals, elevated heart rate, tremor, but otherwise healthy. No drugs in her system, no history of trauma. Her parents described her as ordinary, if stubborn, before the insomnia bloomed. We set up observation. In her room with its bland wallpaper and too bright light above the bed, I watched on camera as Emily lay stiff, eyes open, blinking just enough to prove she wasn't dead. Her eyelids fluttered at intervals, signaling the approach of sleep, but her body jerked awake before she ever faded out completely. She'd tug the covers tight around her, mouth pressed into a nervous frown, and stare into the darkness. That first week was uneventful, aside from the mood on the ward. The nurses whispered that Emily never responded to staff at night. Nobody ever caught her asleep, even when they slipped in quietly during rounds. Early morning, her hair was always wet with sweat. The faint metallic scent of fear started to cling to her room, something natural but unmistakable. It wasn't unusual for stressed patients, but it never faded, no matter the scrub. By week two, odd things happened. Our most reliable night nurse, hardy and unflappable, began nodding off in the break room. She'd jolt awake sweating, complaining of nightmares she couldn't remember. The rest of us have laughed until it happened to the rest of the shift, one by one. Even I, after a full night's sleep, found myself drifting into micro-naps, dreaming of wandering the endless hospital corridors, fluorescent lights buzzing and doors opening to emptiness. Nurses recounted stranger stories as the days passed. Some swore they'd fallen asleep at their desks and felt fingers brush their faces, cold and searching. At least two reported waking to find Emily standing silently by their chair, not moving, mouth slightly open, eyes glassy. Both insisted they hadn't let her out, both convinced they'd woken to find her inches away, only for her to shuffle quickly back to her room when they stumbled up in panic. Staff logs showed her door had never been opened, no time unaccounted for. Some people said they'd simply dreamed it or experienced sleep paralysis. That's what I tried to believe, too. Emily herself never mentioned these events during our early morning sessions. She described only a heavy exhaustion, an inability to close her eyes for long without feeling dreams press in. She said that if she slept, she'd see herself walking the hospital at night. On the nights she nearly slept, her heart monitor climbed rapidly, sometimes pulling alarms without any traceable arrhythmia. The ripple effect spread. Patients in adjacent rooms reported nightmares unlike any they'd had before. Vivid, repetitive, always about wandering hospital halls, half-lit and endless, hearing someone crying softly behind doors that wouldn't open. At least three times a cluster of patients were found in the hall outside Emily's room, sleepwalking with eyelids fluttering, mouths moving. Pulling them awake was difficult. One bit my wrist when I tried, another burst into panic sobbing. Their dreams that morning all matched descriptions. The sense of being called, soft footsteps behind them, a figure ahead whose face never turned. Technicians reviewed environmental reports. Carbon monoxide, toxic mold, faulty HVAC, all clean. The overnight camera system experienced technical glitches only between 2 a.m. and 3:30 a.m. The same hours nurses reported most of their nightmares. Footage during these periods stuttered, sometimes playing frames out of sequence. I pored over hours of recorded static and random flickers, looking for faces or movement. There was nothing concrete, but watching even the cleanest footage put me on edge, like something was watching from just beyond the lens. A maintenance worker swore he saw a pale shape slip into the restroom as he passed, heard whispers in an empty stall. The only person in the hall was Emily, hands at her sides, barefoot and dry-eyed. As the weeks dragged, I changed my routine. I stopped doing rounds alone after one night when, glancing through Emily's door, I saw her standing at the window, hands flat to the glass, looking directly at me. The glass was mirrored. She shouldn't have known I was there, and yet she followed my movements with slow precision. The next morning, handprints remained, thin and oily, pressed from the inside, even after the window had been scrubbed. In her final week, Emily became quieter. She answered questions, but her voice was heavy, almost mechanical. Staff fatigue shot up. Even daytime orderlies reported confusion, disorientation, and a sickly, dreamlike malaise. One nurse crashed her car in the parking lot, claiming she dozed off at the wheel and heard Emily's voice calling her name in the dream just before the impact. After her discharge, things improved immediately. Nightmares faded, staff energy returned, the handprints no longer appeared. The only odd thing that persisted was my reluctance to linger in Emily's old room. The air there still felt heavier, as if it held a faint echo of her sleeplessness. And maybe, if I was overtired, the ghost of those endless corridors I'd wandered in my own fitful dreams. There were explanations, I told myself. Stress, group suggestion, coincidence. But even now, sometimes I wake up in the night and feel like someone is walking the hallway outside my door, just waiting for me to fall asleep so they can borrow my dreams too. Story No. 9. I've been a nurse at Greystone Psychiatric Hospital long enough to know when the air feels wrong. Most of the time, it's just the old vents wheezing or the flicker of hallway lights casting weird shadows. But the East Wing, especially room 217, always felt different, thick with a sort of tension, like walking into a room where someone's just finished crying. When Les transferred into 217, I wasn't worried at first. He was mid-40s with a spiral notebook of diagnoses. Night terrors were his main problem, which made him restless. But in person, he was always polite, if a little distant. He'd been rotated through a few other rooms, but all the beds in 217 were open, so we put him in there. My first week covering the night shift with Les was the usual routine. Hourly checks, paperwork, keeping an eye on an old boiler that rattled loud enough to set your teeth on edge. One morning during shift change, I went in for the daily round. Lisa's bed was neatly made, blanket pulled up and squared, the outline of a body beneath. A pair of worn gray slippers sat at the edge, right where I'd expect after another sleepless night. I marked him down for having slept in. When I went to check his vitals, though, the shape under the covers turned out to be just layers of bedding, perfectly arranged, indented as though someone had lain there all night, but without a person inside. The air above the bed was chilly, and there was a faint metallic smell lingering. I told myself it was probably just a draft, that he'd gotten up during an early morning round and wandered the halls. Still, my fingers tingled as I smoothed out the sheets. That day, the security team pulled me aside. Their camera feed for 217 had gone to static from a little after midnight to about 7 in the morning. Odd, but not unheard of. Sometimes the older surveillance equipment gave out, especially in dead weather. When the feed resumed, it showed Les's door closed, bed empty, slippers unmoved. At the same time, another camera in the hallway showed Les near the end of the corridor, barefoot, staring at the mural. Staff protocol said doors on night check were locked. Nobody had a record of opening it between scheduled rounds. Every shift after that, small things started stacking up. One night, while ensuring meds were distributed, I heard whispering, just a strand of indistinct sound coming from 217. It stopped when my hand touched the door. Entering, the room felt off, heavy and cold. Les, seated cross-legged on the floor, didn't look up or acknowledge me. I glanced at his chart and found it resting on the bedside table, but damp, as if someone had run wet fingertips across the pages. My hands felt inexplicably clammy, and I thought of the metal tang in the air again. After that, objects started going missing. Pill cups vanished from trays before I'd set them down. I once left my notebook on Les's bedside and returned moments later to find it wedged into the radiator, pages warped from moisture. At first, I scribbled it down to forgetfulness. I was getting little sleep and could have easily made a mistake. Except it started happening with other staff too. One CNA swore she opened 217's door for rounds only to see shadows moving around the foot of the bed. More than one, as if two people were seated, but only Les on the roster. Nurses started avoiding 217 during the early hours. Eventually, all assignments near that room grew tense. Lights flickered whenever you passed under the overhead bulb outside the door. The maintenance man chalked it up to old wiring, but no other rooms had the same trouble, and it was always that one flickering, just as you'd get near enough to see your own reflection in the doorknob. It wasn't just lights or shadows. The worst was the sudden cold. Sometimes in the middle of rounds, the temperature in the room would plunge, enough to see your breath for a heartbeat. Once, around 3 a.m., I heard what sounded like someone breathing hard behind me while I was logging vitals. When I turned, there was nothing but an impression in the bedding, like someone had just stood up. Security logs kept flagging anomalies. On the last night I worked that wing, I came in to see every bed on the east side with indentations, though half were empty of patients. One bed had both slippers and a worn men's shirt folded neatly atop the blanket, the shirt damp to the touch. When I picked it up, my hands went numb. Eventually, Les was transferred to a different unit. Officially, it was due to persistent disturbances and nocturnal dissociation, but I think the staff relief played just as big a part. In the weeks after he left, the odd events faded. The air warmed up, lights stopped flickering, and the blankets on 217's bed lay smooth. Some night shifts, years later, I still shiver coming down the hall. Story No. 10. I've worked the night shift at Rose Home Care Center for well over a decade. Elder psych isn't for everyone. Some can't handle the sadness, the confusion, or the way the building seems to breathe on its own after midnight. I've learned to let the small things slide, but the months we had Faye Coulson on the ward, I started questioning what was real and what was just the weight of long hours and aging minds blending with mine. Faye was admitted for advanced dementia. She was tiny, soft-voiced, with cracked nail polish and a habit of greeting everyone with a nod, whether or not she knew their name. The aides called her Grandmother Faye, even though she'd never met before. She'd spend hours humming old lullabies and sometimes seemed lost deep inside herself. But there was something oddly alert about her eyes. She'd sit up late, peering at the hall as though waiting for someone. A behavior not uncommon in sundowning patients, I told myself at first. But it felt different with Faye. She greeted thin air at the door like someone truly stood there, then patted the empty space next to her and murmured under her breath. Sometimes she'd reach up suddenly, as if lifting a child onto her lap. I'd find small, cold footprints pressed into the waxy floor by her bed, even though the other patients in her room were firmly in their own beds, and Faye herself rarely moved at night. At first, my colleagues joked about her imaginary visitors, but when I did night rounds, I began to hear muffled knocks. They didn't always match the rhythm or intensity of patients' restlessness. These were soft, like gloved hands, tapping from inside the walls, mostly from the far end of Faye's hall around 3 in the morning. I chalked it up to old radiators pinging. Still, Faye always sat awake during these episodes, lips moving in silent conversation, nodding every so often to the shadowed corner by the air vent. One night during a storm, lights flickered and I saw Faye standing near the locked stairwell door, hand extended. The alarms never sounded, and when I turned on the lights, she'd returned to her chair, dry and content, a faint scent of lavender in the air. Her favorite, though she didn't have the lotion anymore. The camera in the hall fritzed out during this window, just static for nearly 4 minutes. That same month, the ward's most lucid patient, Mr. Jeffries, went missing for almost an hour. We found him curled up in the storage closet off Faye's hall, crying in his sleep. He kept mumbling about the man with the heavy keys who had come to check the locks and told him not to leave until the knocking stopped. His door was locked and his feet were clean, but the inside knob of the storage closet was smeared with prints, child-sized, greasy. As the weeks went on, belongings began to reappear in odd places. A photo I'd tucked into my locker appeared on Faye's dresser. A nurse found her own pen, missing for days, stuck in the potted plant by Faye's window, wrapped with a lock of her own hair. The maintenance man, a level-headed man with no patience for ghost stories, started showing up pale for shift, swearing he kept hearing Faye humming the same lullaby his mother sang to him as a boy, though he'd only ever passed outside the hall. The worst nights brought the shadow guests. We'd see long, flickering shapes move across the floor in the peripheral vision of the nurse's station mirror, always heading toward Faye's door, vanishing before anyone could turn. Sometimes I'd pass by and see Faye's lips moving, smiling toothlessly, stroking thin air. Her room felt colder after visits, and more than once I spotted extra slippers at her bedside, mismatched and far too small for her feet. Faye's medical charts began to confuse the staff. Notes written in careful, looping script we didn't recognize appeared, sometimes with warnings. Don't let them in tonight. No stairs after midnight. Never open the closet, even for friends. The handwriting wasn't hers, but it matched nothing on file either. Staff began to avoid her hall, subtly shifting assignments or trading breaks. One night I nodded off in the nurse's room and awoke to the fading sound of a lullaby. Words unfamiliar, but melody almost heartbreakingly sweet. I'd been dreaming of sitting at Faye's side, listening as she pointed out visitors in the corners, always just out of sight, and felt both comforted and frightened. When I woke, my shoes were neatly lined beneath Faye's chair, though I should have been 50 feet and two locked doors away. Faye died on a quiet Thursday, hands folded, a faint smile on her lips. She'd been talking to an empty patch of air for days, waiting for her family to finish saying goodbye. After her passing, the shadow shapes disappeared, and the knocks faded back to the usual pipes. We deep cleaned her room, but every so often, someone swears they spot her silhouette in the hall after dark. And sometimes, lavender fills the air just before it lights out. People say dementia makes patients see things that aren't there. Maybe it does. Maybe all those nights blend together in tired minds, turning creaks into knocks, drafts into footsteps, mistakes into echoes. Still, sometimes when I close up alone, I hear soft knocking through the walls, and I remember the way Faye's eyes sparkled as she greeted her invisible guests. And I wonder if our halls are ever truly empty at night. Story No. 11. They all called him Mr. No Eyes, even before I started my overnight shifts on the geriatric ward. His actual name was Aaron Feld, in his late 70s, admitted for confusion and bursts of wandering. The first thing everyone noticed about him was his blindness. He had those sightless, milky eyes, wide open but empty, always fixed in the general direction of whoever spoke. What unsettled me was how well he got around. Most blind patients use a stick or hold the wall, but Mr. No Eyes seemed to know exactly where everyone was. If you walked in the room, he'd swivel and face you head on, dead center, even if you didn't make a sound. People said he had a good sense of smell, maybe sharper hearing, maybe just routines. That's what I told myself the first few nights. It wasn't until my third shift that things started getting strange. Around 3 a.m., while checking rooms, I saw him standing perfectly still by the door to his room, head angled towards the hallway. He wore a faded hospital gown, bare feet on the cold linoleum. As I walked past, I got that prickling on my skin you get when someone is staring. Except he couldn't see, right? I paused and my shoe squeaked, a tiny warning sound. He turned not just his head but his whole body until his useless eyes locked with mine. That's when I backed away, telling myself he sensed me some other way. The overnight nurse said Mr. No Eyes screamed in his sleep, not words but long, mournful wails. Patients next door started complaining of nightmares. One man said he woke up to find Mr. No Eyes standing over his bed, silently mouthing something, despite there being no way he could have gotten in. All doors were kept locked. We checked. The hinges hadn't been tampered with. Security footage only deepened my doubt. I reviewed the tapes after hearing about those nightly wanderings. On two occasions, the camera captured the old man standing outside other patients' rooms, face turned precisely to the bright red lens, always after 2 a.m. Sometimes seconds ticked by and he didn't move, just stared back into the lens. No one ever saw him leave or return to his room, and his door was always locked by protocol. It kept ratcheting up from there. Several staff, including me, started finding handprints on the inside of the thick observation windows, perfectly outlined despite being scrubbed every shift. Sometimes two prints, side by side, right at the spot and height where his hands would be if he pressed up and peered. Once or twice, there were smudges on the staff side of the glass, as if someone had touched the window from the other side during rounds. Aides reported cold drafts passing.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, powered by BetterHelp.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text. and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Through the hallways, even when every window was sealed, there would be a subtle shift in air pressure, a faint, unpleasant chill, always just after Mr. No Eyes had left the common room. Patients claimed to hear a slow, labored breathing in the dark, not matching any room ventilator, coming from corners or right behind their heads. When you turned, there was nothing, just that feeling, heavy and cold, of being observed. It was the scent that kept haunting me. After his walks, the ones we could confirm, the air would fill with a peculiar animal smell, sharp and a little sour, like old sweat and something metallic. I started carrying a small can of air freshener. It helped only for a minute. One night, a female patient was found shivering by the nurse station. She insisted she'd heard someone enter her room and sit at the foot of her bed, just watching, couldn't hear him breathe, but felt the weight pressing on her chest, as if waiting for her to move. When the nurse checked, her sheets smelled like Mr. No Eye's aftershave and bore a faint grease stain, even though he never wore aftershave and protocol banned it on the ward. Staff began talking. Did he sleepwalk? Did someone on days forget to lock his door? A few suggested seismic vibrations made old locks slip, even though it never happened on other rooms. One supervisor blamed copycat hysteria, a mass suggestion carried through restless, sleepless nights. I wanted to believe that. Occasionally, the old man would be found sitting in his locked room, head cocked, smiling faintly at the air, as if surrounded by a group of unseen friends. One nurse swore he heard whispering behind her, in a voice exactly like her own, insisting she come closer, but the room was empty except for Mr. No Eyes, sitting quietly, facing a bare wall. During flu season, 3 patients on the ward claimed to see a dark shape crouched near their windows at night, staring at them, even though none of the mirrors or security clips ever captured anything. Then, as quickly as it started, things began to ease. The cold spots faded, the handprints washed away for good. Nobody claimed visits in the night. Mr. No Eyes grew less active, spending his days sitting in the patch of sun beneath the recreation room window, hands folded patiently in his lap. But I still double-checked the locks before heading off shift, and especially on his floor. Sometimes I catch a faint scent of iron and sweat near his old door, or a draft of icy air just before dawn. Some colleagues say there's always a rational explanation, but when the wind rattles the glass, and I see 2 perfect handprints appear in the morning condensation, I keep my eyes down and walk a bit faster, just in case those blank, sightless eyes are still watching me, even from behind locked doors.